From the West Australian, I'm Ben O'Shea, and this is The West Live.
The West Live.
The West Live
with Ben O'Shea.
On yesterday's show, we spoke to Labor leader Anthony Albanese about his plan to offer a $300 incentive to people who got the COVID vaccine, compared to some of the other incentives out there, which include lotteries, pints of beer and frequent flyer points. That's a pretty decent carrot. But maybe we also need a little stick, and it pays to look at America to see why. The Yanks are way ahead of us when it comes to being fully vaccinated. Only about 15% of Australia's population has achieved that, while the US is sitting at roughly 50%. But the US has hit a wall when it comes to vaccination rates, which is why they're starting to realise the best way forward in a non-mandatory jab program might be to make life a little harder for the non-vaccinated. That's why New York City announced yesterday it will become the first in America to need proof of at least one dose of a COVID vaccine if a person wants to go to a restaurant, a gym, or a performance. The program, which is similar to rules that France and Italy introduced last month, will start being enforced in September, as the Big Apple battles to contain the Delta variant of the virus. 66% of adults in New York are fully vaccinated, but authorities are terrified of Delta, with new cases in America reaching 86,000 a day this week. The key stat to watch here, though, is around deaths and hospitalizations, which is way down on where America was 6 months ago. These days, the only ones in hospital in America are the unvaccinated people. So you can't blame the authorities for getting a little heavy-handed with this group. And we're kidding ourselves if we think we won't have to do the same thing here. Coming up on the show, we'll dig a little deeper into new COVID modelling being used by the Morrison government, plus the new WA training course that could save tradies from asbestosis, and we'll get the latest on the Olympics. But first, let's see what's making news.
The West Live. Making news.
Joining me now is Sunrise correspondent Matt Tinney. G'day, mate.
G'day, mate. Happy hump day. Why isn't it whenever I come in this studio, I turn into like a bull in a china shop. I'm just throwing my phone around.
Exactly. Oh. Exactly. Well, it's because you strolled in here ahead of time today, so you probably didn't know what to do with yourself.
For a change.
Yeah. Normally you puff from running up the stairs from the Channel 7 studio. And now, look, it's go west, young man.
Yes.
That's the motto here for Australians living on the East Coast.
Have you queued up the song, or is that too much in royalties for the budget?
Yeah, that's right. We can't afford that. The Pet Shop Boys go west, unfortunately. No, so you can sing it if you want.
Yeah, that's okay. How about you sing it as I read what's actually happening? So young families from over east are flooding into WA at the moment on the back of our COVID-free status with all of our freedoms. You know, they've probably seen the Mark McGowan video ripping off the mask and over they come. We've recorded now 3 quarters in a row of positive net migration from other states and territories. We haven't seen anything like this since the mining boom back in 2012. So obviously, this is having a flow-on effect, of course, in terms of housing and all sorts of things. Our economy is going gangbusters. There's jobs over here. People from over east want those jobs. They can see how we're living over here compared to how they're living. So most of these young families are coming from New South Wales and Victoria, which is not surprising. The other demographic is sort of that 60-plus group. So people are coming here to raise their children, also coming here to live out their sunset years, maybe. Is that a nice way to put it?
Yeah, that's a nice way to put it.
They're not coming here to die, but they're coming here to enjoy themselves.
Well, that could be a new avenue for tourism. We've seen some countries.
WA, come here to die.
Yeah, exactly. Or you come here to live.
Yes, yeah. It's a great place to retire, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it is a wonderful
especially
time.
Now that the weather's finally turned on.
I don't want to jinx it, though, by saying the weather's turned around, because I just know we're going to be disappointed. But, yeah, I think it's pretty awesome to see all these people coming over. I don't know where they stay, though, because I assume that you'd rent first before you buy. And rentals, you know, it's hard to find a rental property at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, but the thing is, you've got to remember, a lot of the properties over east that they are potentially selling in order to come over here are worth a bomb.
More than
our houses are worth. So they come in here cashed up and buy up.
And they probably look at, you know, and if they come from, say, Sydney, where they might be used to like a ridiculously long commute, they would look at an Ellenbrook or some of these outlying suburbs and go, what, I only have to drive, it's only a 45-minute drive to work? That's nothing.
Exactly, when they're used to an hour and a half and, you know, sitting in traffic.
Yeah, and of course, our response to the pandemic here in WA is a big factor. It's a safe haven. Hey, what's the latest on COVID?
Well, the latest on COVID, we are still COVID-free. The situation in Queensland, they're on the brink of a major outbreak over there. They've got a case up in Cairns. They don't know if it's a historical case or a current case, so they're investigating that. They obviously locked down earlier than Sydney, so you would expect that they would be able to bring things under control in line with what they did in Victoria, but it's still a big worry. You'll remember their chief health officer was saying, you know, if you're under the age of, I think it was 40, like, you shouldn't be getting AstraZeneca. Don't go and get AstraZeneca. Right. And she sort of changed her tune now to speak to your GP.
Basically said in not so many words that it'll kill you.
So as we know with this advice, it was kind of muddled up, but basically ATAGI, which is the body that determines, you know, the rules in terms of who can get vaccinated, what age, who can get it, which jab, etc., etc., they changed their advice based on the outbreak situation. So that's why the advice changed in Sydney, and now we're seeing a bit of a softening, I suppose, in Queensland because of the outbreak there. We are on the cusp of a jab blitz starting over here, which we mentioned yesterday, 2-week jab blitz. So we're expecting to see our figures really go up. We're up to more than 17% of the population over the age of 16 now, 17.3%, I think it is, that are fully vaccinated, and almost 400,000 now who've had both jabs. So we're not doing as well as some other states, but you've got to remember we haven't had the same issues with lockdowns that other states have had. So there's probably not the same impetus.
Urgency.
Yeah, but the target is to get to 80% here by Christmas. And if we do that, potentially, those restrictions will go over the festive season. You know, we might even be able to travel to states over east. Can you imagine?
Well, that'd be exciting. Here's a couple of thoughts for you. The first is, like, we know that people have a tendency, whether they're scrolling through the news online or looking at the newspaper, see the headlines, maybe don't read so carefully the story underneath.
Do people do that?
I've heard people do that. Do you reckon there are some people who looked yesterday at all the coverage of the Albo's $300 $300 vaccine
Where's
center,
my 300
who are
bucks?
In Claremont today, going, okay, got the jab. What about this jukebox? Throw that juice box away. I'm $300. Three pineapples in my pocket, please.
Look, I would have thought, isn't like potentially saving your life an incentive enough?
Yeah. Well, look, you say that, but what I think the other thing that we need to do is incentivize people with a song. Like we saw Carl Sandilands in Sydney, like dominate the news cycle with his Vax Vax Baby. I think there's an opportunity for you and me here.
So with the vaccine blitz.
So I would do a remake of Ballroom Blitz, but it's like it's a vaccination blitz. You see? Wait,
does anyone know
it's
this
kind
song?
Of like punk rock? Well, I should have queued it up, but I only just thought about it. I'm an ideas man.
Do you think it's more effective, though, when people know the song?
Everyone knows a song. Trust me. Everyone knows a song. See, look, our producer Nat, she knows it.
Am I too young? Is this the problem?
It's a ballroom.
Why do I not know this song?
Here we go. Everyone knows the song. Trust me.
Okay. Sounds like Jive Bunny. She knows. Am I too young?
It's got a bit of a swing to it.
It sounds a bit like that song, you know, where it's like, come on, everybody. Okay. How much are you prepared to pay me to sell my soul for this?
And it's kind of like a, you know, a glam rock kind of vibe. So I could see us in, you know, sort of spandex flares.
Oh, is there going to be a video clip as well?
There has to be.
Okay. Yeah, I'm on board.
Yeah. I've seen you in an avocado print hoodie. So Come on. You're not too good for this.
I'm happy to do it. I feel like the song we could work on. I feel like that could be workshopped.
Okay, the costumes might be a bit out of reach, though, because apparently we're spending a lot more money on our cars now.
Oh, my goodness. Cars. So they've gone up almost four times inflation. This is the cost of owning a car. $914 a year in WA for a standard vehicle. I think it's a 1,600-kilo sedan. $1,914 it'll cost you.
Wow.
Whereas if it went up by inflation over 10 years, it should be $600 and something dollars.
Well, that's a big difference.
So we're paying a fortune. This is, and you'll remember the government froze licence fees and insurance costs during the peak of the pandemic, but that quietly changed on July 1 when it all went up 3%. So, yeah, it's costing a lot more. The incentive there to take public transport, but, you know, as we know in Perth, it depends where you live as to whether the public transport is any good.
Yeah, well, I'm hopeful that maybe when MetroNet is finished, then, you know, that will be the tipping point and maybe we'll figure out how to use public transport. Do we have to keep calling it MetroNet, though? Do you know what I mean? Like, you know how other cities have the subway, have the metro, have the tube?
Should we, I think maybe we just call it the metro.
Yeah, they call it the metro. I think Perth metro. Metro. I agree. Yeah. I agree. Yeah. MetroNet's, I don't know.
It's a bit too cumbersome, isn't it? It needs to just be short and sharp.
It sounds like something a supervillain would come up with.
The MetroNet.
The MetroNet. And talking about, well, he's not a supervillain, he's a superhero, the state daddy. And today, he's going to get a lot of publicity for walking across a bridge.
Yes. So we've been talking about this bridge for years, you remember, to connect Perth Children's Hospital to Kings Park.
Yep.
Now, finally, it is officially opening this morning. So kids will be able to enjoy getting some fresh air in bushland, kids that are in the hospital. It's a spectacular bridge. It's rainbow-coloured. It was a vision of a child who sadly passed away at the hospital. So, you know, this is going to be an amazing experience for kids there. Anybody who has had a child in the hospital will already know that Perth Children's Hospital is such a better place than PMH was. PMH sort of started to feel a little third world worldy there by the end. But, you know, Perth Kids Hospital is very colourful. You know, it's very child-focused. This is just an addition to that. So especially for kids that are in there for, you know, a longer period of time, they're going to be easily able to walk across this bridge and go into the bushland at Kings Park and enjoy it like other kids
can. Treatment for snake bites at PCH going to go through the roof.
It's too soon to bring that up. Why did you have to? Here I am building it up, this lovely rainbow-coloured bridge.
All I'm doing is just going on the previous track record of the health system, which is not much is going right.
But they don't need any extra people in there. We don't need any more yellow alerts in our hospitals.
Yeah, exactly.
But I think this is just a fantastic idea, you know, for kids to be able to get across Winthrop Avenue easily, because that couldn't, you know, if you've got a child in a wheelchair, there's no way you're going to take them over to
It's wonderful.
King's
it
Park.
Is wonderful.
It's great. I'm
on board. I'm looking forward to seeing the vision later on today on Channel 7.
Okay.
Matt Tinney, thank you so much, as always, for joining us in the studio. We'll chat to you tomorrow.
We'll do. I'll start to get those costumes ready.
Well, I reckon we all got a bit of a COVID reality check yesterday when the Doherty Institute handed down its report commissioned by the federal government. Despite the Fed's vaccination targets, the sobering reality is there will continue to be coronavirus deaths. Joining me now to unpack the report is Professor Emma McBride from James Cook University. Good morning, Professor.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
And now, can you just outline some of the key takeaway scenarios outlined in this COVID modelling?
Sure. Well, the first thing that the group looked at was the 70% vaccination target, and that 70% of people aged 16 and over, so about 56% of the Australian population. And they've said until we get to that point, we're really going to need to sort of lock down as hard as we have seen, for example, Victoria doing and South Australia and Western Australia for that matter. So short, sharp, early lockdowns. So that's the first thing that they had to say. The second thing they said was that if we get to 70%, at that point, we still need to do things to curtail transmission if there is an outbreak, but we can do a much more light touch. So that's like mask use and contact tracing and isolation and so on. And then we need to aim for 80% before we can really start sort of relaxing things further. So they were the main messages from the Doherty report yesterday.
And so even at an 80% vaccination rate, there still will be COVID deaths, though. That's the anticipation. Is that correct?
That's right. So 80% of over 16s is not sufficient to achieve full herd immunity, and we can't really expect that we're going to have a COVID zero life, certainly not for the next many years. So if you're not vaccinated, you're not as well protected as you might think. And many people are going to be still exposed to COVID. So if you're not vaccinated, there's still that risk of death. And even for those who are vaccinated, vaccines are very good, but they're not 100% effective. So we will expect some people to become very ill, even if they're vaccinated. However, the majority of people who are vaccinated are very well protected by that vaccine.
Mm. And did the modelling give any idea of how many potential deaths there might be? Like, and how would we contextualise that with, say, a normal flu season?
Yeah, so the modelling did have that in it. So if we had a completely unmitigated epidemic, we could be looking at 50,000 deaths. I mean, that's a bit alarmist, but we saw that in New York State, for example, 50,000 deaths, and they have fewer people there than Australia. They're less than 20 million, just under 20 million. So that is possible. However, we would hopefully take preventive and evasive action if that were the case, like we have in Australia. And we've had less than 1,000 deaths in Australia. Now, with vaccination, if you cover about 80% of the population, and if you really cover the elderly, the most vulnerable, very well, you can reduce that to a tenth of that number, so 5,000 or even less if you really get close to herd immunity. But and that's over 6 months to a year. But we can't expect zero deaths. We might be able to get away with sort of 1,000 deaths a year if we really focus heavily on getting close to a point where we have herd protection and herd immunity. And that's comparable to influenza. So we've got to get over this notion of zero tolerance for COVID cases and zero tolerance for COVID deaths. Otherwise, we're going to be in this sort of hermit nation in paralysis for the next... It's going to go on for years. So we've got to make a decision collectively as a nation as to what we can tolerate and just get used to the fact that actually this is an epidemic. The pandemic is going to cause some deaths. We have to minimise that, do everything we can to prevent it and encourage people to get vaccinated, but not assume we can get to zero cases and zero deaths.
Mm. And it makes a big assumption that we could get to 80% vaccination rate. Do you think that is achievable?
Yeah. Well, my view is that what we need to achieve is to have enough vaccine to be able to vaccinate 80% of the country, and that we have a really good campaign, and that every person who's eligible is offered the choice of having a vaccine. And at that point, that's when we should open up, because we can't make a hard and fast rule. We have to get to 80, because what happens if we don't get there? We're sort of sitting around wondering what plan B is. So I think we really need to just say we need enough vaccine that every adult or person over 12, actually it is at the moment, has the opportunity to get vaccinated if they want to, have a really good campaign explaining to people why that's a great idea. At the moment, we don't force people to be vaccinated. So, and nor should we force people who are vaccinated to go into lockdown when there's sort of a recalcitrant sort of 25% of the population who won't get vaccinated. That's their choice. And I think that's the point where we have to relax and go out of lockdown.
Mm. And what did you make yesterday of Anthony Albanese's idea of a $300 incentive to get people to take the jab?
Yeah, a lot of people are thinking about this, and my personal view is, and this is having spoken to people who are reluctant to get the jab, is that people are much more motivated by a return of freedoms than they are by $300. So my personal view is that if you don't get vaccinated and you are therefore at higher risk of transmitting COVID, then you are going to have to sort of be suffering greater restrictions on your personal freedoms. And that's going to be enough of an incentive to get a lot of people vaccinated. Mm. If you want to go interstate or visit friends or go to an event, and people start saying, well, we'd really rather you not come if you're not vaccinated, then that's going to be a great incentive to get people vaccinated. And that's my view of how we should go, rather than giving people cash.
Yeah, right. Well, I mentioned at the top of the show new rules being introduced in New York City that are going to mean that if you're unvaccinated, you're not going to be able to go to the gym, you're not going to be able to dine in at a restaurant, you're not going to be able to go to any live performances, and that's going to start being enforced, I think, next month. So it sounds like that's the sort of thing that you think we should be looking at here in Australia.
I absolutely do think that. And people say, well, that's discrimination, and I understand their concern, but we're not discriminating against people because of their beliefs. We're discriminating against them because they pose a public health risk. And I think there's a huge difference between those two sort of motives. And the other thing we have to think about, of course, is there's some people who really desperately want to get vaccinated who aren't allowed to be vaccinated at the moment. And it's really unfair for those people. And so my view is it's time to open up the age groups to everybody who the TGA, the Therapeutic Goods Administration, says can get vaccinated, and let people be vaccinated and stop restricting it to the, you know, at the moment it's over 40s. Now, there's no good reason we're vaccinating over 40s and not vaccinating the 20-somethings. Who are the people spreading the actual virus at the moment, and they're the ones we should be targeting.
Yeah, probably the ones least likely to stick to some of the restrictions as well. And
yeah, they've got lives, you know. That's the thing. They want to get home.
They got FOMO. What about the kids? What about kids under 16? The 12 and up cohort are able to get the vaccine in some places now. And then what about even younger than 12? How are they included in this modelling, or are they not included at all?
Okay, so this is the thing about the modelling. If you believe that the reproduction number for the new COVID, the Delta strain, is as low as 3.6, which is about 40% more infectious than the original strain. So that means on average a person who has the infection will infect 3.6 others. That's what the Doherty has assumed. That's a fairly low figure. It's pretty optimistic. That's what they've gone with. Now, if you believe that, then you really don't need to vaccinate teenagers and younger children. But if you believe that that number is as high as 5, so an average person might infect 5 others, then without vaccinating the teenagers, the 12 to 15-year-olds, we will never reach herd immunity. It's just not possible. So it just really depends on what the infectiousness of the Delta strain turns out to be. My view is that it's more likely to be 5. So I'm very strong on the idea that we need to vaccinate our children right down to 12. Now, lower than 12, we don't have enough data about it in terms of safety, but we'll have that data within months because the trials are being done in the US for Pfizer in the 5 to 12-year-old group, and that information will be available very soon. So if it's safe, then I would say we should go even lower. And it may end up being that COVID vaccine is a childhood vaccine in the future. We don't know yet. So, yeah, so that's a really important point. And I think if the proof is in what we're observing right now about teenagers. We are seeing COVID transmitting amongst teens in Brisbane and in Sydney as well. So, the proof is right there in front of us that we're going to have to address transmission in the young teens.
Well, let's talk about Brisbane. Queensland, of course, is dealing with its biggest COVID outbreak since the first wave last year. 16 new cases today. Now there's a case up in Cairns. They're not sure if it's historical or not.
Yeah.
Now, do you think the situation seems under control, or is there still a lot of concern about where this outbreak could go?
Oh, no, I think it's very much up in the air. It's a bit like Sydney a month ago or whenever it was. This is the Delta strain. It is much more infectious than the original. So the intensity of tracking and tracing and isolation and quarantine has to be, so much higher. Now, on the other hand, we have a vaccine now, and that is our strategy. That is our, special, It's our way out of this. So what we need to see is much higher uptake of vaccination. In Queensland, we have the lowest vaccination rates in the country, and in Australia, we have one of the lowest vaccination rates in the OECD. We are so far behind, we've just got to pick up our game and get people vaccinated.
Mm. And finally, before I let you go, we mentioned Delta. To what extent do future variants that we don't know about yet risk making this modelling look redundant?
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think the model's robust. It's similar to mine, and so I'm not going to criticise it too much in terms of the outcomes and the inputs into the model. What it needs is to sort of look at, well, what if we get an even more infectious agent? And so the modelling that I've done, you can actually go online and anyone can look at it, and you do a sliding scale and say, well, what if we get something that's even a little bit more infectious? What is the impact of that? And so we can look at how that might change the policy around it. So, for example, if the agent is as infectious as 5, like I said, you will need to go down the age groups and vaccinate the teenagers at the very least. If it's as high as 7, we'll never reach herd immunity. It's just not possible with the current lot of vaccinations. So we need to be able to be very nimble and change policy based on that, especially with these new emerging variants all that are coming through all the time. Absolutely. Good point.
Stay light on our feet. I think that's the answer to responding to this pandemic. Mm-hmm. Professor Emma McBride from James Cook University, thanks for sharing your insights on The West Live today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And now we've got the latest figures from New South Wales in today. We didn't get it from TikTok, where I believe the New South Wales Health is now streaming their press conferences. Quite bizarre, but that's the reality these days. So New South Wales has recorded 233 new locally acquired cases of COVID-19 in the 24 hours to 8 p.m. last night. Around 47 of those were infectious in the community. 103 are linked to a known case or cluster, and 79 are household contacts, 24 are coast contacts. So, not amazing news from New South Wales today.
You're listening to The West Live.
Every year in Australia, between 700 and 800 people are diagnosed with mesothelioma, a rare and aggressive cancer that doesn't have a cure. The vast majority of those cases come from an exposure to asbestos. The material has been banned in Australia since 2003, but it's estimated there are still 5 million Aussie homes that contain it. And WA has the highest rate of mesothelioma. So what are we doing about it? Joining me now to tell us is the Director of Skills Development at the Construction and Training Fund, Rob Berryman. Good morning, Rob.
How are you going?
Yeah, good, thank you. And now, we all know asbestos is the boogeyman of the construction industry. How much of an issue is it?
Well, Ben, it's been around for a long time. And what we need to do is educate the younger entrants into the construction industry to ensure they're aware of asbestos, because they could be moving through to renovation work or maintenance work where asbestos is really prevalent across the board.
Yeah, well, let's talk about those renos, because we know they're going through the roof at the moment. Everybody seems to be doing something to their houses. Because, I know in the general public, there'd be a lot of people who maybe think, oh, asbestos, that's something from the past, it's been banned, don't have to worry about that. But I imagine there's probably this whole new generation of tradies who don't have much experience dealing with it.
Yeah, well, how this came about was with Joe Morris from Reflections. And going back, it was probably about 2017, She came across to North Metropolitan TAFE at the time and said, look, what are we doing about asbestos for our young students? So we started having some discussions. So in the end, we met with the Construction Training Council, which is part of the Construction Training Fund, and said, well, what can we do to improve this? So what happened was we developed some resources, albeit fairly basic at the time, and from there we've now introduced an awareness program, which is very interactive. It's quite hard-hitting in the factual part of it for young people to be really aware of the dangers of asbestos when they're on a construction site, or they might even be doing some other type of work outside of construction. So the outcome is, albeit it's been a bit of a journey, but we've got a really good product now that we've rolled out to the training organisations to say, here's an awareness program and it's part of your curriculum. In other words, it's a core unit or subject that each pre-apprentice or vet in school student can complete when they're doing a construction training course.
Yeah, and so is it accurate that this is the first time a state has introduced asbestos awareness training for pre-apprentices?
I wouldn't like to quote that we are the first, but I tell you what, we're one of the top high priorities because we run a very strong foundation certificate 2 programs in construction. And part of that is asbestos. So occupational health and safety, don't get me wrong, asbestos has always been part of that. But what we've done with this module is put it straight in the forefront of the training of young students.
Mm. And so what is the hope as far as how it might prevent tradies from getting asbestosis down the track?
Well, it's, you know, buyer beware. Like if, for instance, you've got a lot of renovation and do-it-yourself type activity happening in the market, And quite often, people don't realise that the old Lido, quite often the underfelt was asbestos. So people don't understand that, whereas what we want to do is make sure the younger people coming through have a really good understanding of the safety, because construction is all about safety, as we know. So what we've got to make sure is the young people coming through are well aware that it's not something that happened in the past. It could be active, and it is active and live in our building industry at the moment, especially in the older construction.
Well, you just taught me something there, Rob. I didn't actually know that felt under lino was potentially asbestos.
Well, it's part of some of the older, how would you say, how people actually laid the lino, and quite often it was part of that.
Yeah, wow. It's pretty scary. I remember my nana pulled up a lino floor and replaced it with cork, and I'm pretty sure there was no asbestos prevention methods taken there. And so how many tradies will end up doing this course?
As far as tradies go, they're sort of looked after through different programs. Like, you obviously know the HIA MBA, the CMFEU, they all offer what we call Cert 3 and above training for asbestos. And that could be demolition, could be Certificate 4 programs. So what we're trying to do is get the foundations right with a Certificate 2, and then from there, people, if they choose to, can go into different careers. They might go into asbestos removal. So that would be an option for them. But at least they've had that groundwork understanding of what asbestos is, what it looks like, what it feels like, with not touching it, of course, but a clear understanding that, okay, this could be dangerous. Talk to my supervisor. What do we do here?
Yep.
Because there's a lot of opportunity there for people to get the experts in to make sure the site's safe.
Yeah, long overdue, I reckon, with WA having the worst rate of mesothelioma over the last few years. And what people might not realise is the average age of exposure when it comes to this stuff is 23 years of age. So it's those young tradies that we really need to train up. Director of Skills Development at the Construction and Training Fund, Rob Berryman. This course sounds like a very good idea, and hopefully it'll save some lives down the track. Thanks for being on The West Live.
Thanks a lot, Ben. Have a good day.
Some pretty shocking information has come to light about the number of attacks on workers on Perth's public transport network. Joining me now from the Public Transport Authority is David Hines. Good morning, David.
Good day, Ben.
So what sort of attacks have been reported? Who's being attacked?
The main target that we're talking about here is our transit officers, and they're the guys who they're dressed similar to police officers. They've got blue shirts and uniforms. They generally are wearing orange vests, and they're the people who patrol our stations and our trains to make sure everyone's safe. They're our thin blue line, as it were, in terms of passenger safety and security.
Mm. And so what are we talking about here? Are these incidents happening when they are going up to, talk to or confront someone who's maybe causing a bit of trouble on a train, and then they're being attacked?
Predominantly that, Ben. There's not a lot of spontaneous attacks, although some of those do happen as well. It's as you say, when they intervene, when they're doing their job, keeping the system safe and operating efficiently and effectively for the wider community, people who are just not behaving well. So it may be times when they witness some antisocial behaviour, or they witness some bad behaviour, an assault or something like that, and go and put themselves in harm's way, as it were. They intervene on behalf of the rest of us to try and make it safe, and the person being spoken to does not react well.
Mm. And so what sort of an increase have we seen?
Look, we've been tracking it over the last few years. For instance, just looking back over the last 3 years, in 2018-19, and we're talking about financial years here, 168 APOs, and APOs is the terminology. It means assault on a public officer, because in legal terms, our transit officers are considered to be public officers, as are police and I think AMBOs and paramedics and perhaps nurses. In other words, people who are doing a job on behalf of the public who are assaulted in doing that job. So a couple of years ago, 168, then the following year, 174, and the year just completed, 206. So that's a reasonable step up, particularly given that our patronage numbers fell away, well, the previous year, but also particularly this year because of COVID.
Yeah, so because of COVID, you've seen that passenger numbers have gone down, attacks have gone up.
Yes.
Yeah, right.
Exactly.
And so where are the worst hit areas? Are there some stations or some lines where these attacks are more prevalent?
Looking at the stats, the way we break it down, it's on the Armidale, Joondalup, Mandurah, Fremantle, Midland, and Thornley line. Now, Thornley lines, to be honest, it's just a little spur line off the Armidale line. But also, we consider the Perth precinct to be an entity in its own right, and that's Perth Station, the Underground, Esplanade, plus MacIver and Claysbrook, the Armidale / Midland line station, which are right almost in the CBD. And the Perth precinct always has been the highest number, probably for the fairly obvious reasons, is that's where, you know, there's a congregation of sometimes antisocial behaviour and antisocial people. But then looking on the lines themselves, the Mandurah line has big numbers, but then that's not unreasonable because the Mandurah line has the biggest number of passengers as well. But then the Armidale line, which is always a hot spot, continues to be a hot spot.
Yeah. That's probably pretty much what we'd guess, I suppose. And is there any way of knowing what's fueling this increase?
Look, not really, and I'm not a social engineering expert. But I think it's important to note that the public transport is just a microcosm of society as a whole. So this is happening, and I think it's fairly well documented in the West and elsewhere, that there does seem to be a bit of an uptick in antisocial behaviour and violent incidents. Having said that, it's probably a bit of a function of COVID as well, that people have been under pressure because of COVID and the various restrictions that COVID has brought about. And even though we in the West are doing better than most, we still have issues with people who are not happy about, whether it be, you know, distancing, wearing masks or whatever it might be. It's, in some instances, the behaviour that our transit officers have to intercede against, it has come about because somebody has objected to somebody else standing too close to them or not wearing a mask or coughing, something like that. So I think COVID probably can be put down to, can be said to be a part of the factor as well.
Mm. And so what can the PTA do to, I guess, help protect the transit officers? And are you at risk of losing them, like, to other jobs?
Well, our transits are really a very dedicated bunch. I mean, I could not do their job. They put themselves in harm's way every day on behalf of the PTA and on behalf of the community as a whole to make public transport, which is an essential service, to make public transport better for everyone. But we do have a big support structure around them in that they receive a lot of training and then regular refresher training in all aspects of the job. And that can be, for instance, they're trained in mental health awareness to look for people that might be possible self-harmers. They're trained in dispute resolution techniques, talking people off the edge, sometimes literally as well as metaphorically, as well as self-defense techniques. That, for instance, they're armed with pepper spray, but part of sending people out with pepper spray is that they also have to be trained in aftercare. So every officer who's carrying a pepper spray can also has the aftercare kit, which is sterile water and cloths and so on to help people recover from that. So there's a lot of training, there's a lot of equipment, but the biggest part is the technology we have around them. All the officers are in constant communication with the shift commander, who sits at a central location where, with our CCTV. So every interaction between the public and transit officers, whether it looks like it's being adversarial or not. Every interaction is filmed on CCTV, and we keep that vision, so that if we need to then go to court with it, we've got the vision that shows exactly what happens. And in doing that, in monitoring their activities, trained people are able to very quickly to make an assessment as to whether we need to send backup to help them. So they've got the whole organisation, the structure is designed to support them in doing their work. And the other part of it is they always travel in pairs.
Mm. Well, let's hope we see some positive results in the numbers going forward, because we want those transit officers to stay safe because they keep us safe. Public Transport exactly. Authority spokesman David Hines, thanks for your time on The West Live.
You're very welcome, Ben.
And now, this is one of my favourite parts of the show over the last week or so, where we get to cross to Tokyo, speak to someone on the ground at the Olympics, and for Sunrise Sports reporter Mark Beretta, that ground has been moving today. G'day, Mark.
G'day, Ben. How are you?
Yeah, really good, mate. Now, the earth has been moving for most of us with the number of gold medals Australia has been winning, but it's been literally the case for you today.
It was pretty bizarre. I've never been to an earthquake before. We were just about to go to air with Sunrise about 7 o'clock this morning. I looked up above our cameraman. I just noticed that the roof was swaying back and forwards, and I thought that's a bit unusual because we broadcast from a tower which is about almost 10 stories up out front of the main stadium. It's a tower that normally would probably be made of scaffold, but in Japan, because they earthquake-proof everything, it's actually made of heavy construction steel. It's a very solid tower, and it is made for just occasions like this. Anyhow, it started moving, and I noticed the lights on either side of the camera were swaying backwards and forwards, and we all looked at each other and had a bit of a laugh, and it was an earthquake. It was I think it was a 5.8 magnitude set in Fukushima, and look, to the locals, it's no big deal. To us, it was an earth-moving event, yes.
Wow. I've been to Japan myself a bunch of times, and it's obviously a very earthquake-prone place. I've never experienced one myself. But I've got to say, I don't really envy you going through it, Mark.
No, look, it was interesting. It's not something I would wish on anyone else. I think it's probably the unknown. We're very lucky. We've got a wonderful guide and driver, Anthony, who keeps an eye out for us. And our deal with him is he obviously knows the lie of the land. He said, I will message you and you'll know when to get out. So we've got a good little system with him. So, but no, it was unique and unusual and quite, it's not a violent thing. It wasn't a violent experience. It was just a gentle rocking. And, you know, I guess the more the rocking becomes big rocking, that's when you've got a problem. But it was quite unusual just to see how everything moved. You know, it was incredible.
Yeah, wow. And now we're going to talk Olympics, of course. Before we get into the sport, though, there's a lot of talk in Australia at the moment about our returning athletes and some things that they might be doing on the way out of town. The Rugby Sevens boys made a bit of a mess of their accommodation, allegedly. Now we've heard reports of the Aussie Roos on a flight. What's the talk over there in Tokyo about the behaviour of Aussie athletes?
To be honest, a huge disappointment. And it's such a smear on a team that has been so exceptional in what they've achieved and is still achieving and will still achieve over the next few days. This sort of thing can just, you know, just take the shine off and destabilise the team a little bit. And, you know, that's really sad because it has been such a good game. It's been such a great event for Australia. And then, you know, there's been some room damage in the athlete village. You know, that's every 4 years, every 2 years with Winter Games, we go away and we represent our nation. And we don't like to do that. That's not the impression we want to leave on the rest of the world. It's not how we want to leave the host nation. And the Japanese are such hospitable, warm, wonderful hosts. That's not the way that we want to, you know, say thank you for having us. So I think there's a huge level of disappointment in what went on. There was a couple of nights ago, a big bash in the accommodation. Some walls, beds and rooms, bathrooms have been damaged. The culprits appear to be a group of rowers / rugby players / Aussie Roos soccer players. Obviously not everyone, but just a handful, a very small handful, and then carried on the flight on the way home. So they drank a lot on the flight on the way home and carried on a bit with the crew on the flight. And so what happens, the process is the AOC goes back to the individual sports and says, hey, listen, you're out of line, you're lost. We want to know who, we want to know what's happened, and we'll we'll take it from there. But the reports are currently coming back. I think the report is back from football, if I remember right. I think they've reported back with names. So we'll just see what falls out today on that. But they'll be pretty swift in dealing with it. And they will be dealt with, because, and rightly they should be. That's just, it's just way out of line and hugely disrespectful.
Mm. And if there is a plus side, it's that the Japanese don't really already have the best opinion of Australians, having seen the snowboarders and skiers that we send over there every winter. But, you know, hopefully the rest of the team does us proud in the remainder of the games. Let's talk about the sport. Where were you last night?
But glued to the TV last night watching the hockey, and the Kookaburras were unbelievable, knocking off Germany. They've come through two massive games. They've beaten the Netherlands second last game and Germany last night, two world superpowers of hockey. And to be honest, every time Australia and Netherlands and Germany come together, it's a heavyweight bout. You know, it's just an incredible, incredible game, and it was. The Kookaburras are so on at the moment. You know, they're just playing brilliantly. They're fast up and down the field. They're defensively strong. They're in attack, they're strong. A 3-1 was the scoreline, and you know, that's an impressive scoreline for a semi-final. So they move on now to play for hopefully for the gold medal. So yeah, great performance by them. That was brilliant. And then the Boomers, of course, just awesome up against Argentina. Wow, they
smashed
it up last night. And a tournament like the Olympics, you often hear tennis players talk about it in a Grand Slam, where they say you play yourself into a tournament like this. You're only peaking in the first match you play. You've got to work yourself into it. And the Boomers are doing that perfectly, as are Team USA, their next opponent in the semi. So that's going to be a really interesting clash. It's a clash we had to have. We always knew it was coming somewhere along the line. Australia beat them in the warm-up tournament in Las Vegas. So, you know, Australians will go in with nothing to lose. They'll give it a good go. And we've got the same thing. The Opals have got Team USA in the women's draw, so it's going to be the women's is a quarter final, the men's is a semi, so both against Team USA. So next couple of days, big ask of both our basketball teams.
Mm. Well, to be the best, you've got to beat the best, and that's the task ahead for the Opals and Boomers. And what's on your dance card for today, Mark?
I've just arrived back at the main stadium. Just went off to have a little bite this morning and just reassess the day, and I'm just heading in to see some of our great Australians in action today. And, of course, Peter Bowl tonight in the 800 metres is probably our greatest hope. A quick shout-out, too, to our swimmer in the 10K, Karina Lee. She's a surf swimmer from up Noosa Way in Queensland. She picked up a bronze medal in the women's marathon, the 10K swim, this morning, which is a gutsy effort. So bronze medal for Karina Lee, which is added to the tally, and that was really fantastic. But Peter Bowl tonight, 27-year-old Sudanese refugee, came to Australia running in the school meet, and the school coach saw his talent and said, you should go on with this. And here he is at the Olympic Games. So, you know, he's a great story. Fled with his family from war-torn Sudan, and finds himself now at the Olympic Games about to represent his new country. And, yeah, just brilliant. I can't wait to see how he goes tonight. There's a big talk about Peter Bowl and how good he could be. And we haven't had a man win that event, the 800 metres at an Olympic Games, since 1968 in Mexico City. So it's a big occasion for Australia tonight. And, of course, the Opals are back in action again tonight, which is great. So up against Team USA is a beauty. Yeah, much going on. It's like, as I said, it's four grand finals every day for 2 weeks.
Well, there's a lot of excitement around Peter Bowl over here in the West. He grew up in Perth, and he wrote a column in our newspaper, The West Australian, today, revealing, you know, a lot of his thoughts going into this final. I know all of Australia, especially Western Australia, will be behind him, and we'll be behind you as well, Sunrise reporter Mark Beretta. Thanks for all your work over there in Tokyo. We're loving watching you on the TV, and thanks for being on The West Live.
Thanks for having me for the chat, and thanks for the support. And sayonara from Tokyo, the Olympic City.
The Wild West.
Joining me now is Perth Now editor Nat Richards. G'day, Nat.
Good morning.
How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. It's
so interesting calling Tokyo every day and talking to the journalists over there working on the Olympics, and today with Mark Beretta experiencing an earthquake. Mm. Just the last thing you expect.
I tell you what, it's all happening over there, isn't it? It's just a gift that keeps on giving.
Yep, just like the Sussexes.
Yes. Well, it's Meghan's 40th birthday today, guys. Which, why should we care? The reason why we should care is because I'm putting money on today being the day we get the picture of Lilibet.
Who is the latest child, is that correct?
Yes, she's the latest royal baby. Baby Lilibet, we've yet to see her. I reckon today's going to be the day. They tend to choose occasions like Father's Day, Mother's Day, special events to show off pictures of their children. And I reckon today's going to be the day that we get our first glimpse of baby Lilibet.
Because we've seen the back of her head, right? Was there a baby photo where there was no face?
No, we've seen nothing.
I haven't seen it, and so nothing.
We've seen nothing of Lilibet.
So we don't even know if this baby exists.
Baby Archie, they were very careful when they showed him off for the first time. Remember those pictures at Buckingham Palace? And they sort of hid him from view a little bit. We got pictures of his feet and God knows what else. We're getting a lot of black and white pictures. I mean, I can understand people wanting to keep the kids out of the media, but unfortunately for them is that a lot of British people in particular feel like these kids are public property. Mm. They're potential monarchs.
Yes.
And they're funded by the public, from the public purse as well.
Right. So, I mean, their taxpayer dollars have bought that baby. So, it's not weird at all.
It kind of is a weird view that us Brits have, that we sort of feel like we're entitled to see these children. But now that they're not royals, I mean, it'd be interesting. They are part of the royal family, obviously, but they're not working royals anymore. So it'd be interesting to see how they handle this one. They might keep her out of the press completely. I find that very hard to believe. I reckon Lilibet's going to be out there before long, and I reckon today's the day.
Do you know anything about the birthday party?
I do. Well, I know bits, but not personally, but from various...
You haven't called Oprah to find out?
I have not called Oprah, but the reports going round are that she's contacted Oprah's party planner.
Oh, yeah.
And arranged a very lavish get-together at her own home, which is, of course, a mansion.
Yep. You can imagine that party planner. A gift bag for you, a gift bag for you, a gift bag for you.
Yes. Apparently there's going to be grazing plates with local produce. That sounds very Meghan, doesn't it? Very woke.
Is that allowed during a pandemic? Can you have grazing?
Yeah, they are allowed. They're allowed get-togethers over there, apparently, in California. No. So she's going to have a very small get-together with only 65 people. Let me remind you that I only had 25 at my wedding, guys. Yeah. Like 65
that's
people.
Small, though. That's small. Like if you're
is
a,
it small?
If you're a,
is it
a
small
duchess,
for a house?
If you're a duchess having your 40th birthday, I think 65 is very small.
I can have 65 people around at my place. I don't know what your place is like, Ben, but blimmin' heck, 65 people.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway,
hang on, they've got chickens. They've got a chicken coop.
They've got a lot of room.
They've got a Native American stream.
They've got a lot of room. So 65 people, this get together, they're going to have a naked cake. Now, that's not, now steady on, that's not what we think it is.
Is that what we saw in the movie Under Siege? Where actress from Baywatch jumped out of the cake on the
I doubt it's going to be one of those kind of cakes. Unfortunately, I think it's going to be one of those very boring cakes that doesn't have a lot of icing on. So, very rustic looking cakes.
Oh, yeah.
So apparently she's got one of those on order. This guy, though, that's arranged the party, his name's Colin. I can't remember his surname off the top of my head, but this chap who's the party planner, he's known for arranging bashes for the likes of Kim Kardashian,
Tom Cruise,
Michael Jordan.
That's the real deal.
He doesn't muck around, so don't think
it's not going to be some carrot sticks and sausage rolls.
No, it's not going to be a few cheese platters, a few, cocktail sticks with pickled onions and cheese on. Oh, no.
The pre-cut cubes of cheese. Probably not going to...
This will be the real deal. This will be an intimate gathering of 65 people in a mansion with the works, I reckon.
Oh, wow.
And I reckon today might be the picture we get the first look at baby Lilibet, so... You can quote me on that tomorrow
food,
when
to
we
honest.
Don't.
Yeah, okay. Well, I will. We'll look forward to the follow-up to that tomorrow. And now, look, let's talk about the track and field in the Olympics. We just crossed to Mark Beretta. Now you're going to bring us another Olympic story.
Yeah, did you watch the pole vaulting last night, Ben?
I did not. No, I missed the pole vaulting.
I quite enjoyed it. And it wasn't only because Armand Duplantis, and I'm hoping I've got his name right there, leapt to an incredible height, 6.02 metres. It was, the guy can fly. It was amazing. It was so good to watch. He's an absolute...
Where's he from?
Legend. He's from Sweden.
Yeah.
He's 21 and he's just it. Like, I mean, I know that we
Is there something more going on here than just his athletic ability? You seem very enthusiastic about this, Nat, I have to say.
He's an absolute dreamboat, Ben. He's an absolute dreamboat. And it's not only me that says it.
Let me just have a look at him.
It's not only me that says it. Everybody on Twitter is going mad over this guy.
He's like
a... You can see him?
Yeah, I'm looking at a picture of him right now. And look, if I had to describe him, I'd say he's like a more athletic Timothée Chalamet.
And you know what? That's exactly what people are saying. Is that,
oh, there you go.
He's got the Hollywood look about him.
Yeah, he does.
And you know what? What's not to love? The guy can fly. He's a world record breaker. He holds the world record for pole vaulting.
He's got a big pole.
Yes, Ben. And he's got a gold medal. And look, he looks hot. So, you know what? Hats off to him. He's going crazy, though. Like, the guy's on the internet. He's just...
Can we find out how many Instagram followers he's got, Mel? Could you look that
I'm
up while we're talking about
right now, actually.
Oh, surprise, surprise.
I've been doing the research. He's got a model partner. Sorry, girls.
Oh,
guys.
So he's got... Oh, okay.
He's got a model partner. She is... Yeah, here we go. His nickname's Mondo, by the way. He's only got 320,000 followers, which isn't a lot for a guy world at his sport.
He probably only had 200 yesterday. So he's probably gone...
He's got pictures of here of him playing chess, so he's cluey as well.
All right. Or at least he can pose next to a chessboard.
This is it.
So don't believe everything you see on the gram. But, you know, I find this whole thing very offensive, Natalie.
Do you?
Yeah.
Go on.
Very
Why?
Offensive. Very
Why?
Offensive. Well, imagine if instead you came into the studio and I said, oh, Nat, I've got to talk to you about this female pole vaulter. Oh, my God, she's so beautiful.
I'd probably agree with you.
No, but you couldn't do it these
days. Are we
you
really at the stage where we can't tell somebody that they're nice looking?
No, no. Look,
like, have we really got to that?
I think, to be fair, we've probably had, only, like, I don't know, 50,000 years of men talking about how attractive women are. So we could probably live with years of it going the other way.
I'm just saying that he's gained a bit of a following over this.
Yeah.
Like, honestly, the Twitter sphere, as they call it, is going off about this kid.
Well, we missed it from the opening ceremony because everyone was wearing masks and there was also not very many athletes walking in the opening ceremony. Normally, the biggest story out of the opening ceremony is, you know, the top 50 most attractive athletes in Tokyo, male or female. We didn't get that this year, so good on Armand Duplantis from Sweden.
Mondo.
Mondo. What is that? What's that about?
From his
Armand.
Nickname.
Armand.
Is his nickname.
Armand. Mondo.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So, and he got a gold as well.
He did get a gold. Right? He's very good at his sport.
Because it's when you get the kudos for being good looking and not necessarily achieving.
I don't think it's just his looks, though. I think it's his manner as well.
Yeah,
having watched him last night, he just seems so... Get lost, Ben. He just seems so... There's something very charming about him.
Yeah.
You know, he seems quite modest and sort of laughing at himself when he didn't, you know, make the...
Was he in a tight outfit or like those flappy shorts that they wear?
No, he was in the tight outfit, Ben.
The tight outfit, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Okay, well, thanks for that. Will, is he competing again? That's it, he's done.
I think that's
he's done.
He's the best in the world at his sport, so I mean, you're going to be better than that, do you?
Yeah, no. Oh, good on you, Armand. You've made at least one person in Perth very happy with that gold medal. Thanks for joining us, Nat Richards. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Thanks, Ben Tura.
Well, that's it from me. You can download the full show or individual interviews by searching for The West Live online. And of course, if you're loving the games, be sure to download Let's Go Tokyo with myself and Mark Reddings. We'll keep you across everything at the Olympics. Available wherever you listen to your podcasts. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to The West Live with Ben O'Shea. If the story behind the story matters to you, then you can count on the west.com.au to deliver.